Based on the observation, if you're talking about fun at camp, don't look so grim. So, I can't send the mixed message. I'd like for us to all turn over to Matthew chapter 7 and verse 21. Matthew 7 and verse 21. There are so many different observations in this particular chapter, but when we get to chapter to 7, verse 21, it says, "Not every one that says unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that does the will of my Father which is in heaven." I think we all identify that with wanting to do the will of God the Father in heaven. We know that it takes more than just words. Words alone don't cut it. Christianity is far more than words. And not everyone that says, Lord, Lord, gets results. We want more than that. I think we understand the value of having answers to prayer, having blessings, having our needs met, and being able to have a sense of well-being and prosperity where things seem to just work out and that God is looking out for us. Now, along with that, let's turn over to Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11, verse 6. There is an enormous amount of thought that's compacted into this particular verse. Hebrews 11, verse 6. It may be a memory scripture for you. It says, "But without faith it is impossible to please God." It is impossible to please God without a relationship with God, without faith. For he must, that comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those that diligently seek him. So there's a lot that happens in this particular verse in order to get the results that we need, in order to have a relationship with God that means something, that is real. And that is that we are to pursue God, and that we got to believe that he is, and that that's based on being able to prove it, that we know that we know. We're absolutely sure. Absolutely sure. And then confident that he is a rewarder of those that diligently seek him, that he will provide our different needs, whatever they are. Sometimes he does that in conventional ways, other times in ways that we would never even dream of. And I have a few examples of that to mention today. It boils down to this. Is your God, is my God real? Is my relationship with my God real? Is God real to you? Is it something that's kind of, well, he sort of exists, or he's in the background, and I'll turn to him if I'm really in trouble? Or is he a God for all days and all seasons and all situations, in times of trial and times of peace, whatever, that God is real for us? Sometimes we can be so close to the tree, we don't see the forest. We can be so familiar with Christianity, churchianity, coming, knowing that we have had a relationship with God, that sometimes, if we're not careful, we can lose the tangibility of a powerful relationship with God. I'm not saying that anybody's doing that. It's just the potential does exist. And so it's valuable for us to take some time to raise the question today, how real is your religion? How real is my religion? There are endless examples of how God can become real to us, how he made a difference to other people. And when you see how that is, you have to marvel that God is a God of all people, and it doesn't matter what your age is, or what your or my background is, that God is there to reach out and help us and is able to respond to our communication, our prayers. And for the trials that we face, we need a real God. We need to know that we have a real relationship. Not, oh, here I'm in a trial. I sure hope God is going to help me. Well, what, you know, how does God feel about the situation? Well, I haven't really studied it out in a long time. You know, we don't wait for a crisis in order to come to a depth of appreciation for the fact that a real God can make a real difference in our lives. I'd like for us to turn over to 2 Chronicles chapter 33. 2 Chronicles chapter 33, and we'll read about a very young individual who had a real relationship with God, with the real God, which is the same God that we have a relationship with. 2 Chronicles 33. In verse 21. Here it says that Amon was 22 years old when he began to reign, and reigned 2 years in Jerusalem. But like so many of the other kings before him, he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord, as did Manasseh his father. For Amon sacrificed unto all the carved images which Manasseh his father had made, and served them. In fact, King Manasseh did actually repent and get rid of a number of the false idols. And so his son went to the extreme of trying to find them, locate them, resurrect them, and put them all up again. Verse 23, he humbled himself not before the Lord as Manasseh's father had humbled himself. And Amon trespassed more and more. And God allowed for his servants to conspire against him and slew him in his own house. But the people of the land slew all of them that had conspired against King Amon. And the people of the land made Josiah his son king in his stead. Well, that might seem like a doable situation. Let's see if the son could do any better. The challenge was the son was only 8 years old. In the next chapter we read where that's stated that way. Josiah, verse 1, was 8 years old when he began reign, and he reigned in Jerusalem 31 years. And he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord. And he walked in the ways of his David, his father, and declined neither to his right nor to his left. Here's a person of focus. And did God bless him? Did his example stick out like a sore thumb after one bad king after another reigned and disappointed God? And now here comes a child, and he knows right from wrong already. There's a story behind that. We don't have the detail. Somebody must have been teaching him. But the main thing was he was focused. He was going to try to obey God. What does that tell us? That it's even possible at a very young age to be spiritually focused, to be serious about one's relationship. And Josiah apparently was. No doubt there were perhaps adults out there that were trying to steer him, but he was his own person. He was the king, and as he got older, he became more and more responsible for all aspects of the kingdom. But there was not a time when he was dabbling with these false idols. Verse 3, for in the 8th year of his reign, when he was yet young, he began to seek after God of David his father. I would be thrilled if it was recorded of me that I had also seeked after God, whether I was 20 or 60 or 80 or whatever. That's rather impressive to be 8 years of age and you're already have honorable mention in the Bible, of all places. This person was focused. I suppose a number of people thought he was going to be a pushover. It seems like in the history of the world, you name any country, almost any organization, there are always politics. People wanting the next rung up, wanting to move up the ladder. And there are perhaps people that thought, oh, man, we've got a kid running this country. Well, we got to be close to the people that he's surrounded by. And if we can ingratiate ourselves, why, we can get a piece of the authority. We can decide, help steer the country, maybe bring in the false idols again or expand them. It is so often the case in history. In the United States Congress years ago, the majority leader of the House of Representatives, Sam Rayburn, would always meet the freshman congressmen that were coming in, that were newly elected. And his advice was, quote, if you want to get along, you got to go along. And that meant compromise, give and take. And I imagine that there were politicians, there could have been, especially since there were evil reigns that preceded this one, where different people in the court thought, I'll pick my moment and I'll bribe the king. I'll exert my influence. I'll be the most powerful lobbyist. I see opportunity here. Eight-year-olds, they're not that cunning. They're not able to discern. They're not street smart, aren't they? But they didn't have this particular eight-year-old apparently had God's spirit. He knew right from wrong, and he was going to hold to the right, and his God was real to him. He probably had not lived long enough to know all the political shenanigans that could happen at a palace, or that perhaps it occurred in the centuries prior to his life in Jerusalem. But he was riveted on doing what was right for the right reasons. His religion was real at an early age. Perhaps my people thought later, I can't understand. He's already 10 years of age. We can't bribe him. He's not interested in wine, women, or song. He's only 8 or only 9. Well, I'd bribe him with Legos, but they haven't been invented yet. I don't know what's the sky spirit chink in his armor. You know, in the late 70s, there was the Abscam scandal where the FBI deliberately created a plot to have several people represent themselves as Arab sheiks. And they would go to members of Congress and say, you know, we are very influential people. We want certain things done in this country. And if you play ball with us, we have a little monetary gift of $150,000 we'll give you, and we'll give you, and so forth. And they actually had 7 or 8 members of Congress and 1 senator accept that. And I can remember 1 Florida representative, when he was on trial, they said, well, why'd you take the money? And he stammered and says, well, I was doing my own investigation. You know, went over like a lead balloon. That really happened. I have not seen the movie, which I don't need to because it looked a little risque, but notice that they made a movie out of Abscam that's come out just recently. And the premise was you can buy all kinds of influence with all kinds of people, but the men and women of God are not for sale. And in Josiah's case, that seemed to be clear. And for the next number of years, let's read what he did. For in the 8th year of his reign, now he's a teenager, he's 16 years of age. When he was yet young, he began to seek after the God of David, his father. In the 12th year, he began to purge Judah and Jerusalem from the high places and the groves and the carved images and the molten images, all the things which so many pagans were still worshiping. And they broke them down, the altars of Balaam in his presence. Excuse me. And the images that were on high above. He cut down in the groves and the carved images and so forth. He was at all-out war declaring against these pagan elements. Burnt the bones of the priests upon the altar, the people that were the priests of Baal. He cleansed Judah and Jerusalem. And he did so in other cities of Manasseh and Ephraim and Simeon, even to Naphtali. And when he had broken down the altars and the groves and beaten the graven images into powder and cut down all the idols throughout the land of Israel, he returned to Jerusalem. That is focus. Boy, that's being real with God. That's like saying, you know, we're declaring war on what's wrong and we're upholding what's right. And, you know, it says in the Proverbs that when the leader does that, other people, wow, they take heart and they follow. In a good way. And so it was a very powerful example. And he just did not let up on that. And I'm not going to read the entire chapter here. But I'll just suffice it to say that verse 9, when they came to Hilkiah the high priest, they delivered the money that was brought into the house of God, which the Levites that kept the door had gathered it, of the hand of Manasseh and Ephraim and the remnant of Israel and all of Judah and Benjamin. In other words, now that Josiah was reestablishing the religion that God had intended, people, out of respect, out of, you know, a proper, awesome fear of God, they started to tithe or send money into the treasury, and now the Levitical priesthood was able to operate once again. The whole country was coming to a grinding halt, but it took a riveted person that was focused, that had a real relationship with God, to turn it around. It was a child, in a sense, who became a very convicted teenager and a very convicted young adult, and he made a difference. And so there were blessings involved. And you can read for the next several chapters of how that translated into the resurrection of Holy Day observance and how Josiah was able to turn the country around. And at this point, you had to wonder, was Judah ever going to get it together again? Because it kept slipping and slipping and declining, and it looked like it would just fall out of sight. It would be like in this country, you see the U.S. dollar continued to decline and decline, and then rumors talk about going off the U.S. Dollar, you know, worldwide, and the increase of gold because the dollar is worth less, and this is what we see, an increase in corruption on so many different fronts, and people becoming, feeling helpless, like, what can we do about some of these things that we read about? And so much partisan politics, while the ship continues to sink. And then a child emerges out of nowhere and is in charge of the country and says, we're going to follow God. And lo and behold, it becomes a powerful example and the rest of the country follows. What are the odds of that? It would only be possible if there was an intensity, a spiritual intensity, and God was there to bless that. But this is what happened in ancient Judah. Josiah made a big difference. Josiah was not for sale. He was focused. I'd like for us now to turn over to 1 Samuel 16. 1 Samuel, go back a little bit to 1 Samuel 16. We'll read of a couple excerpts about somebody we're quite familiar with, and that's David, who became king of Israel, who would have been great-great-great-grandfather of Josiah, or something like that. And in 1 Samuel chapter 16 is when the prophet Samuel was asked by God to anoint King David to be the king in place of King Saul. So Samuel had never met David, didn't know who he looked like. Went over to Jesse, excuse me, and chapter 16 and verse 7. I'm sorry, verse 3. And call Jesse, God said, call Jesse to the sacrifice, and I'll show you what you shall do. And you shall anoint him whom I shall name unto you. Samuel did that which the Lord spoke and came to Bethlehem. And the elders wanted to make sure he was coming peaceably, that he wasn't on, you know, that he was not angry with them in any way. Peaceably I come to sacrifice to the Lord, he said. And then he sanctified Jesse and his sons and called them to the sacrifice. And when they were come, Jesse had 8 sons. And obviously Samuel wondered, well, which one is it that's going to be the next king? And so he looked on Eliab, perhaps he was the oldest. And he said, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. And God said to Samuel, no, don't look on this countenance or the height of his stature, because I have refused him. For the Lord sees not as man sees, for man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the inward heart. Those that have a real relationship with the real God know that outward looks are not important. outward words are not what it's all about, but there's some deeper essence. Verse 8, Jesse then called Abinadab and made him pass before Samuel. Samuel said, neither has he chosen this. Then Jesse perhaps looked at his third oldest, made Shammah to pass by. And God said, no, neither has the Lord chosen this. And Jesse made all seven of his sons pass before Samuel. And Samuel said to Jesse, the Lord has not chosen these. Probably at this point, Samuel's thinking, maybe I made a mistake. I don't know. I thought God gave me clear instructions to come here. I'm starting to have some doubts, maybe. But no, these are not it. Samuel said, I should have rephrased that, you know, or Samuel might could have said, I might be questioning myself. Other people in that position might have. But thinking back to Hebrews 11:6, you know, he must believe that God is, and that he is a rewarder of those that diligently respond. In other words, if God says, this is what I want you to do, it's going to go the way God wants. So Samuel probably was very confident. I've looked at seven sons, and these are not the ones. So he said, do you have any others? And the father said, well, I've got the youngest. He's out with the sheep. You know, he's not in the king's army. He's not as tall as the others. I don't consider him on the map yet. So God could work with anybody. David was maybe a teenager here. If God could work with Josiah, certainly could work with David. So Samuel said to Jesse, send and fetch him, for we will not sit down until he comes here. Verse 12, and he sent and brought him in. Now he was ruddy, actually handsome, had a beautiful countenance, and was goodly to look to. And the Lord said, arise and anoint him, for this is he. So Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brethren. And the Spirit of the Lord came to David from that day forward. Now, he probably already had a relationship with God because he was doing some very unusual things, like killing lions and bear. It's not your typical activity, even for adults. But in protecting the sheep, I think we're familiar with the story that he was able to do that. He was also an accomplished musician, but he was very much committed to living according to the way of God. And one thing that we've stressed in the church, and so echoed over and over again at the camps, God's way works. That's been one of the mottos of the church. And David was trying to obey God just for the sake of obeying God. He wasn't trying to, quote unquote, get ahead. Wasn't interested in making a lot of money. Wasn't interested in politics. He inherited a position in government, of course, later, but he was just trying to take care of the sheep and sing psalms and out in the wilderness, and he was happy with life. But it's amazing that he was riveted for God. He was riveted to a real God. Now, if we jump ahead to 1 Samuel 17, we go to, let's see, the fact where, verse 28, David was asked by his dad to take supplies to his brothers, his older brothers. So he was willing to do that. So he left the sheep and he went to where this battle was. It was a big showdown between Goliath and the Philistines and all the Israelites. And when David got there, verse 28, Eliab, his eldest brother, when he spoke to the men, Eliab's anger was kindled against David, and he said, why did you come here, and with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your pride, yeah, and the naughtiness of your heart. You came down that you might see the battle. It's amazing how people will accuse others of their own problems. Maybe so when he said, I know your pride, I would wonder if Eliab was the one with the pride issue. That so often that can happen that way. David was exasperated. Well, what have I done now? There's no cause for this. And he turned toward another. David didn't respect him. He didn't respect David, apparently. David went on and talked to other people. Hey, what's going on here? I hear these words out there. Somebody's taunting us? Oh, you don't know the half of it. Oh, where have you been? Why, don't you know there's a giant out there? And we're intimidated. This guy is ready to rip one of us apart, and he's challenging us to send out a fighter. And everybody was cowering in fear. You know, they'd been sitting there. You know how cats can kind of square off and they'll at each other, you know? It can go on and on and on for hours, and especially at night if it's outside your bedroom window. And it's like the same thing was happening. The Israelites were in one part of the Shephelah Valley, and you had the Philistines in the other, and they just... just back and forth, you know, and Goliath every morning, who will fight me? And I'm just demanding somebody, stand up to him. And then everybody's cowering. In fact, it is embarrassing. The king, head and shoulders above everybody, 7.5 feet tall, Saul. He's down there too. And so David, as small as he wasn't maybe a full height yet, but he had total confidence. And with confidence that he had from the relationship with his God. And he's just moving around the camp, and he says, what's going on here? Who is this guy? Oh, did you hear what he said? He's defying the living God, that goon out there, this guy. Oh, that gets me upset. And, what'll happen to the guy that goes to fight him? And so, you know, he's standing out. The word gets around, and it gets back to the king. Wow, there's a guy that's not intimidated. Oh, really? Really? Is he good with his fists? Is he a good fighter? Can he throw a spear? Well, no, but he's so confident. So, yeah. So then it gets back to Saul, and it doesn't take very long. Saul wants to meet this guy. Now, David's brothers are probably thinking, I'll go back to your sheep. You're an embarrassment to the house of Jesse. This is disgusting. But instead, he's right up there talking to King Saul. And that might intimidate people. Oh, I'm not so worthy to be able to stand in front of you, the king, and so forth. Blah, 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 blah. You know, keep stumbling over himself. But David just marches right up. He says, verse 32, let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight this Philistine. And Saul said to David, you're not able to go up against this Philistine to fight him, for you are but a youth. He's a kid. You can't expect much from a little kid. You're a kid. You can't do that. And he's been a man of war from his youth. And David said to Saul, your servant has kept his father's sheep, and there came a lion and a bear, and took a lamb out of the flock. And I went after him, and I smote him. Yeah, finished him off. He was dead meat. And delivered it out of his mouth. And when he rose against me, I caught him by his beard, and I smote him. You know, I do this all the time. I tell you, I know what I'm talking about. And your servant slew both the bear and the lion, and this uncircumcised Philistine is just as one of them, seeing that he has defied the armies of the living God. How dare he do something like that? That's the way he was. He was convicted. He didn't think that Israel should have been buffaloed by intimidation of Goliath. And so he keeps on talking. He says, your servant slew both of these. Verse 37, and moreover, the Lord that delivered me out of the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, he'll deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine. He was convincing. Here, the future of the entire country now revolved around the confidence of this young man in a climate of fear and doubt. And if they lost this confrontation, the Philistines would have them on the run and overtake the rest of the country. And those that survived the death, the killing would be made as perpetual slaves of the Philistines. So everything hung in the balance. And Saul said, "Go and the Lord be with you." Now, he was overwhelmed, Saul was, with its confidence of David. When people are close to God, that's where they become bold. To be as bold as a lion, you and I have to be is in harmony with all of God's laws. If we're in harmony with two-thirds of them, we're not going to be bold. We'll be sort of there on the map, but not completely. But if we are 100% for God, the boldness can match that of David. And in the future, we will need that. I think Gerald Waterhouse has said some, talking about some of these leaders, or Elijah, he would say, all for God and none for the devil. All for God, none for Baal. So here it is that David has Saul's backing. Then Saul armed David with his armor. You know, he's using physical reasoning. I mean, if you're going out against a giant, you need a helmet of brass. You need all of the weaponry. You need a spear. You need armor. And David tried to wear this, and it was nothing that he was familiar with. And he said, no, he look, I live off the land. I can't carry all this stuff. It's as heavy as I am. And, of course, the armor was designed for somebody much bigger than David. And so he took them all off. Now he felt like he was in his element. He went and grabbed 5 smooth stones out of a brook, put them in the shepherd's bag, and then marched over to Goliath. And when Goliath saw him, he just about had a cow, as they say in the vernacular. A double take. He's stunned. He's insulted. He's shocked that they come to him with a little kid. What is this, he says. You know, who am I, a dog, that you mock me to come to me like this? And David is not fazed at all. He doesn't care how tall Goliath is, or how heavy his spear is, or how fast he could throw it. David, where's that confrontation here? Verse 43, the Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you've come to me with staves? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. I don't know if David understood the language of the Philistines. Perhaps it was close to his own, but he knew what the intent was. And the Philistines said to David, come to me and I'll give your flesh to the fowls of the air and to the beasts of the field. That would have scared everybody else that was in the Israel camp. Verse 45, then David said to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword and a spear and with a shield. I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defiled. Whoa! This day will the Lord deliver you into my hand, and I will smite you, and I will take your head off of you, and I will give the carcasses of the host of the Philistines this day into the fowls of the air, to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And the people are listening to this. Wow, you hear what this guy's... Listen! Yeah, if they had earphones, you know... Man, he's really gone. He's gone too far. He's going to get creamed. That Philistine is going to he's riled up Goliath's anger so much that he's going to not just kill David, but let's count how many seconds it'll take, how few seconds it'll take to do it. He's going to slice him up and spit him out. But David's the one that had the confidence. He served a real God, and he felt the real power of God. And he was inspired. And he knew that he was in the right. And he knew that there was no danger in this. And amazingly, and this perhaps bamboozled Goliath. Instead of, you know, using careful warfare and then hiding behind the target and throwing that spear, he runs right at him. He runs right at him. Is that how we approach our trials in life and our challenges? I'm going to take control of this. I'm going to take no prisoners in a sense. Get serious. Turn it around. Ask God's help. Make it happen. David ran right up against this huge obstacle called Goliath and took his sword, drew out the sheath, and slew him, cut his head off. And when the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. They should have had the upper hand. They were the ones that had the armaments. They probably outnumbered the Israelites. Excuse me. But not so. Not so. This was preceded, of course, by David's sling that accurately found its mark on, with a stone planted on the forehead of Goliath. I don't know if you've ever seen a sling in operation, but it is a very, very deadly weapon, and especially when used right. I think I'd rather be shot than be taken down by David's sling. At any rate, that was a demonstration of powerful faith. Now, later on in life, David lost that because he wasn't 100% for God. In his middle age, somewhere along the line, he started to drift. And it didn't happen in a split second or overnight, but he got into trouble. And you know the story. He ended up with, between murdering Uriah and the situation with Bathsheba, you know, that was a low ebb for him. And then he remembered the pattern of success earlier, and he reconnected with God in a very powerful way. And God knows that he was a man after his heart. And God knows that he wants somebody that real to be with him for all of the future. And therefore, David is going to be king over all of Israel once again. Let's go over to 2 Kings chapter 5. 2 Kings chapter 5 is another amazing story of not just a king of Syria that invaded Israel, but that was Naaman. But Naaman had leprosy. And for all of his military prowess, we can read in 2 Kings 5 where Naaman was struggling to survive because leprosy was a very dangerous disease and threatened to take his life. And he didn't know really what he should do with the rest of his life. In chapter 5, and verse 1, now Naaman, captain of the host of the king of Israel, of Syria, was a great man with his master and honorable. Because of him, the Lord had given deliverance to Syria. He was also a mighty man in valor, but he was a leper. So he had some redeeming qualities about him, even though he was not an Israelite. But verse 2, and the Syrians had gone out by companies and brought away captive out of the land of Israel a little maid, a little girl. And she waited on Naaman's wife. We don't know her name. We don't know her age. Perhaps she was 11 or 12 years of age. Perhaps was fatherless. We don't know. But she obviously had some previous instruction about God's way of life. And when she, probably for days, she had talked to Naaman's wife and had understood that Naaman had leprosy. And she said to her mistress, it wasn't overnight, but after a while, she said, oh, would God, my Lord, were with the prophet that is in Samaria, that being Elisha, for he would recover him from his leprosy. In other words, I enjoy working with you, and I know what your husband's going through, and I feel for him. And if he would just meet the prophet Elisha, I know that he could help him. I know that the God of Israel could intervene for that leprosy. I know that. Here she is, a child, but she's convincing and makes a difference. Now, it could easily have gone that if a person like that had insisted, you really ought to get rid of the leprosy, you could be healed of that. That nobody heard of things like that before. That just doesn't happen. When you're a leper, about the only thing that you could hope to do is end up in a leper colony, and your life was productive life was over. But she was confident. Had she suggested that to somebody else, it's easy to realize that a different leader would have said, that is not only a bunch of garbage, but you don't even belong here. This is a wonderful position. You're able to help, you know, the wife of one of the top leaders of Syria. We're going to put you in a slave camp. You don't belong here. You know, you can't be spouting off crazy ideas. But she had a way about her. And maybe Naaman was one that could be reached. That he had a bit of humility in spite of the fact that he was a military general. So she was confident. To me, if they made a movie of something like this, I think that the little maid would be Shirley Temple, you know, at age 10. You can do it. You know, you can get rid of your leprosy. But it's true. That's the way it happened. And so, in one verse 4, and one went in and told his Lord, saying, thus and thus, and the maid said, that is of the land of Israel. And the king of Syria said, go to, I will send a letter unto the king of Israel. And he departed. In other words, okay, that sounds good. This little girl seems to know what she's talking about. A young woman of faith. And so I'm going to send a request to the king of Israel for permission to come all the way into his country and meet this man that can help me. Well, that probably scared the Israelites. Oh, no, this military leader's coming deep into our country. And he's claiming to cure himself of leprosy. No, it's a plot to take us over, you know, to get a military advantage on us. So that didn't go over very well. The odds of this playing out this way were almost zero. The likelihood of Israel saying, oh, yeah, you just come on down with your army and just camp right in the middle of Israel and do what you have to do and then go home when you feel like it. That's cool. That wouldn't normally happen any more than a general of an army would listen to a little girl. Again, it'd be like Shirley Temple telling in World War II General Patton, I know this secret little dirt trail that you guys don't have on your maps. And if you follow it, you'll get to the other end of the Europe twice as fast. Yeah, right. But that's the way things could happen. And it did happen that way. Let's go over to Job chapter 12. Job was another situation altogether. Now, Job already had a remarkable relationship with God. I think that so many times when people discuss him, they do not give him credit for having been a righteous man and for doing some marvelous things. We speculate maybe in Egypt, nobody knows exactly whether or not he was a pharaoh or an assistant, but he had unusual responsibility. He was wealthy. He used his money to help people. He had compassion for the poor, for the widow. It says in Job 29, he made the widow's heart sing for joy. He did many wonderful things, and he knew it, though. And yes, he was self-righteous, but to really be fair about it, you have to give Job credit for so much. And so I'd like for us to go over to Job chapter 16, 1 through 8. Here we're coming right in the middle of the story between Job and his three friends that had continually chastised him. And chapter 16, verse 1, then Job answered him, answered and said to them, I have heard many such things. Miserable comforters are you all. He's getting frustrated with his three friends. He's probably thinking, with friends like this, who needs enemies? Shall vain words have an end? Or what emboldens you that you answer? I could also speak as you do. If your soul were in my soul's stead, I could heap upon up words against you, and I could shake mine head against you. But I would strengthen you with my mouth, and the moving of my lips should assuage your grief. Though I speak, my grief is not assuaged. Though I forbear, what am I eased? But now he has made me weary, and has made desolate all my company. And he's It's basically, woe is me. And it's understandable. And let's go over to chapter 29. The thing that sticks out here is that he is so absorbed in himself. Just take a look at and start counting the number of pronouns that you see in chapter 29. See, I'll just start reading here in verse 2. Oh, that I were in the months of past, in the days when God preserved me. And then moving down, when his candles shined upon my head and brought his light, I walked through darkness, and I was in the days of my youth. I'm inflecting differently to drive home a point. It's all about him. Have you ever met anybody where it just seemed to be all about them? That they seemed to be so, they thought they were so important that nothing else mattered. Here, Job is frustrated with these friends, and he's trying to ramrod his points home. And it's not that what he's saying isn't true. It's just that his whole focus is on himself. Verse 14, I put on righteousness and it clothed me. A person that's really close to God sees the greatness of God and is not going to say something like that. Verse 15, I was eyes to the blind and the feet, and was I to the lame. I was the father to the poor, and the cause which I knew not, I searched out, and I broke the jaws of the wicked, and plucked out the spoil of his teeth. Then I said that I shall die in my nest, and that I shall multiply my days in the sand. My root was spread out by the waters, so forth. You see the pattern there? Would you get a little tired of listening to somebody like that? You know, I did this wonderful thing. It was me all the time, and I had all the ideas, and I did this, and I did that. You say, okay, let's do something else. But Job was emphatic about that. Now, God realized the other people that came to Job were not going to penetrate his self-righteous barrier. So God finally addresses Job out of a whirlwind. And he challenges him. And he says, in chapter 38, verse 1, who is that dark counsel by words without knowledge? In other words, Job, you're talking about things that you don't even know about. You gird up your loins like a man. I'll demand you that you answer me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if you have any understanding. Who's made the measures thereof, if you know? Who stretched his hand upon it? And the foundations, where have they been fastened? In other words, the earth seems to float, as Isaiah says, he hangs it on nothing, and it floats, and it's in the air. You know, how come it doesn't have a foundation? Where do these stars come from, anyway? Do you know what the composition of those? Do you know what a supernova is, or a crab nebulae? Do you know where the Milky Way is, and where it ends, and where these other ones are? How far is Andromeda from the Milky Way? How many other things? If you had a Hubble telescope, how many galaxies are there? 10, 12, 1,000? Do you know? Were you around when I made these things? Do you know what angels are? Do you know what their composition is? Do you know what spirit is? Have you ever seen it? What about lightning? How come it moves the way it does? You know, where does the wind come from? How high up are the stars? And just start pummeling them, question after question after question. Where were you when I created Orion, the Pleiades, and some of these other constellations? Do you know what a snowflake is? Do you know what it looks like under a microscope? Well, you don't have microscopes. But I can tell you when it's really tiny, and if you were to have it expand, you would see that not any two flakes are the same. The crystals are absolutely beautiful. The water freezes at 32 degrees. Do you know why? I made it happen that way. It boils at 212, and it's always that way. And he kept pummeling Job. And finally, we get to Job 42. Job 42. Then Job answered God and said, oh, I know that you can do all things, and that no thought can be held from you. Who is it that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I have uttered that which I understood not, things too deep or wonderful for me which I knew not. Hear, I beseech you, and I will speak, and I will demand or ask and plead with you and declare unto me. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. I thought you were a great God before, but I didn't know how real you really are. And when he said that, his self-importance went to nothing. He had done many wonderful things in his life. God was impressed. But God was able to correct his inflated ego, and now Job was even more valuable to him. God was now pleased with Job, actually doubled his blessings, restored his family, and made an enormous difference in Job's life. But Job had to come to see himself, and he humbled himself, and by doing that, he saw how much greater God was than he had ever dreamed that he was. It made a difference. Wow, you mean if I have a relationship with God, I'm hooking myself up with, I'm linking up with a God of power, a God of ability, of love, of concern. You know, if God takes just a tiny fraction of his greatness, he can make a difference for people. We have ABC classes up at Cincinnati, and I don't know I guess it would cost a couple thousand dollars if you save your money and then have money for, to get established for rent somewhere. And so it's a bargain, but it's, you know, some money, and people have to work and save for it. And years ago at Ambassador College, I was estimating maybe the cost of 1 year would be 4 to 5 times that. And there was a time, know the person, was accepted to Ambassador College in Pasadena and had worked hard all summer. I don't know how it happened, but she had underestimated the actual real cost of getting there. And with what remaining money left, took a bus all the way out there and was shocked to find out it was far, far more, in the thousands more than what she had prepared for. And for some reason, the bursar's office didn't take that into account or communicate. All she knew was she had a limited amount of money, and it wasn't going to get her into college, and there was nothing in the budget for her to get back home, nor was there money from any other source to make that happen. And she fasted about it. She felt scared more than anything. And God works in different ways. I don't know why or how. I'll just make up the name. Hillary Jones. But after the bursar office told her, "We're sorry, you cannot attend Ambassador College. You're going to have to go home. And how you get there is, well, you can maybe take money out of our refund. But we hope that you'll get home." And that was felt like living there and suddenly having no friends in the world. And then somebody, after she slunked out of the office a few minutes later, some stranger nobody ever saw before or since laid down an envelope, said, "This is for Hillary Jones," and turned around and left. It was the exact amount of money that would cost to get her matriculated and enrolled for that opening year. Actually, I know of another person who's in the ministry today where that same thing happened. You don't know what's possible sometimes. We had a church member years ago, a farmer in Oregon. He was just come into the church, and he believed in tithing, and the pastor of the congregation was talking with them and said, "I really feel for you guys. We've had a terrible, terrible flood, and it looks like everything's been flooded. All the crops are being wiped out." And he was upbeat. He says, I know, but I know that God will take care of me. I don't know how. I know that things will go work out for good." And everybody prayed for his situation, but most people expected it to be rather dire. And he didn't lose heart. And then it turned out, just a few days later, that when the waters receded, that his field was hardly touched at all. And what was wet was have high enough ground that it would dry out and there was still enough time to plant that area all over again. And so when the crop finally matured, he was one of the few to have a crop at all. So everything that he sold from what he raised was for like 3 and 4 times what he would normally get for it because there was no other source for it. And so that's how God worked that out for good. Sometimes we forget who we're linked up to. Fred Keller, as I remember in a sermon long, long ago, got a phone call at 3 a.m. Now, not all of us are mentally sharp at 3 a.m. unless we're working the night shift. I remember one other minister saying, I want you to know you can call me anytime. But the advice you get from me at 3 in the afternoon will be a little bit better than at 3 in the morning. So in this case, somebody called him and he said, hello? Yeah? Okay. Yeah, sure. He rubs his eyes to try to wake up. Somebody was in a desperate situation and needed prayer. And now I'm remembering it's a different minister, forgive me. But it was his assistant. And rubbing his eyes and saying, and he gets on his knees, he said, Father in heaven, please help the person that called. I have no idea who it is. I don't even know exactly what it is, but I know it's very, very dangerous. And you need to help. Well, this is a time for a real prayer to connect with a real God. And he felt awful, not knowing any of the details, even though they were explained. But a few days later, the Sabbath came, and the person ran up and said, thank you very much. Your prayer made the difference. You know, God intervened. He came through. And that's right. Yeah, God came through. So he didn't take any personal credit for that. Let's take a look at James chapter 2. Now, the book of James is absolutely amazing. We don't have time to go through it. I wasn't trying to, but... some people will say, the bad thing about religion is that there are hypocrites. You know, they say something and do another. Well, if you read the book of James, you can see that sentence after sentence he's talking about not to be of pure religion and undefiled and not double-minded. In James chapter 2, he talks about the need to not just know what to do, but to actually do it. And he says, verse 17, even so, faith, if it has not works, is dead, being alone. Yes, a man may say, you have faith, and I have works. Show me your faith without your works, and I shall show you my faith by my works. Now, notice this. There are several conclusions that are fascinating out of here. Verse 19, you believe that there is one God, and you do well. The demons also believe, and they tremble. Now, they tremble, but they're not wanting to obey God. That's one thing that amazes me. But the main focus of coming here to this verse now is that the demons may believe, but they have no works of righteousness. They don't have a working relationship with God. Any number of people can come to God and believe that he is, but are not diligent to pursue God. It's just like what we started off with in Matthew 7:21. They are no different than those that say, Lord, Lord, but do not the will of God. I was visiting my brother out in Denver, and I was amazed. He belongs to a mega church. There must be 10,000 people. They have incredible facilities. A number of services, TV cameras on this huge stage in an orchestra pit and everything. And they run hundreds and hundreds of people through every couple hours for various services. And it looks quite impressive, the trappings of it. And one of the ways that I was wondering, how do you get 10,000 people to come? Well, you go through all the big snack rooms and all the other rooms after services, and they've got, video screens where they'll show the Dallas Cowboys or the Denver Broncos That's a football team. And they'll have that, widescreen television. Then for the teenagers, they've got a ping pong room, 17 tables here. And that's just one of the many auxiliary rooms. Now, I was a little bit baffled because my brother and I, it was on a Wednesday afternoon, he was giving me the tour, and we decided to play ping pong. And some people came and kicked us out. So, as a, I don't want it to go on my work resume that you know, I managed to get kicked out of somebody, some church's ping pong room, but that's what in fact happened. And the bottom line is that there are all these glitzy gadgets and other things that really have very little to do with the Bible that lure people in. People think, yeah, this really fits. This, I don't have to change here. This just accommodates my lifestyle. They won't let me bring my six-pack in, but otherwise, you know, I feel right at home here. Yeah, so my wife got religion. I can come along. I'm meeting guys that are into football and other activities, and there's a fishing group, and there are things to do during services if I get bored. And, you know, they've got something for everybody. But there's something that's missing. Are they in tune with? Are people in tune with the real God if they're looking for extracurricular stuff to keep them amused? I think of one time meeting somebody who visited one of our church services and said, well, we're just looking around. We're shopping around. Mm-hmm. What that means is, I'm looking for a religious system that will give me permission to do what I want to do anyway and what I'm going to do anyway. Well, here's one. They got ping pong. They got billiards, pool tables in the other room. I can relate to a group like this. Snacks are good. And, you know, what else is there? I'm being facetious, but people don't give religion more than a cursory acceptance. You have to make time to make God real. God, I don't think, is real to people that are just into amusing themselves. What I pray for when I ask God that He will grow the churches is that He'll bring people that not only have an interest in the truth, but they have the gift of repentance, that God will give them that. That they will really see that for life to amount to anything, they have to, we all have to surrender to God. We have to live by what He says works. God's ways work. Well, what are the ways of God? Well, the Bible shows it. To be in harmony with that, to surrender to it, to say, yeah, God, You're number one in my life. That's what's important. Have to make the time for that. In prayer, you know, sometimes people complain, well, I was on my cell phone and the static was just, you know, really fuzzy. Sometimes people have fuzzy static trying to pray to God because maybe their heart isn't in it. They don't see that He's real. Well, you know, it's abstract. Am I just putting in my time, or am I really getting somewhere with a relationship with somebody up there that can make a difference in my life down here? You know, God is real. Sometimes we're not real with Him. So we have to change. We got to surrender to God. We have to make Him important in our lives. Now, need to conclude here, and I've only covered a few examples of people that had real relationships, that had breakthroughs. I could do the sermon this afternoon and just use totally different examples to make the same points. We've got examples among ourselves and in other congregations of people that have made a difference for God, that needed God's help and got it when they, and it's in the key times, because their relationship was real all of the time. How real is your relationship with God and mine? It's worth us asking ourselves that on occasion and trying to reacquaint ourselves with His power. It comes from studying about God and talking to God in prayer. As busy as Jesus was on this earth, in Mark 1:35 it says He would get away a great while before the day, before things got too busy and started taking off, get away, private time, pray to God, talk about the day's events, the things that were important to Him, and then about other people, others' needs, and so forth. It has to be that real to us. Well, we have that opportunity. We live in a land that allows us the freedom of religion. We have some discretionary time. We're busy, surely we are, but we can make time to be able to acquaint ourselves with the great God and with his interventions in the past. Mr. Armstrong would say, you know, he got great encouragement reading about what God had done for other people. One time, I might have mentioned this, he came back from one long trip around the world, and at his age, he looked ash white. He looked like he was death warmed over. And for whatever reason, I guess he couldn't sleep, he wandered over to the basketball game that was going on. I saw him from a distance, and when it ended and everybody's funneling out, I inched over to him. And I said, "Oh, Mr. Armstrong, we just ran the television station Detroit, the one-hour special with your son, and we got this huge response. It was 250 responses, and it was unannounced." And he said, "Really?" And he just stood like this. Oh. And he goes, "Good." And he walks out with a little bit more pep. You know, he just thrived on that, on good news, on God's intervention. And studying about that can do a world of good for all of us, because our future is with God. And our relationship, if anything, will just continue to expand forever. So let's not waste time now. Let's do what we can to make our relationship with God as real as it was for David, as it was for Josiah, and the little Shirley Temple maid whose name remains anonymous, and the other people that made a difference at all different ages. God is a God of everyone.